And I just love that piece of literature. You know, we have a lot of really, really neat Al-Anon literature, too. let's see. Anonymity. Newcomers do not understand anonymity. And I don't know, sometimes a lot of the old-timers don't seem to either. You know, anonymity doesn't mean that you don't know my name. My name's Mary Pearl Thompson. I have no problem with that. What if you try to find me in the phone book? How would you find Mary Pearl? You know, Pearl's not my last name. You know, I'm from the South. We have all sorts of names. You know, Bubba Pearl, what can I say? But, you know, we'll be so anonymous within our group. That's not what it's about. The anonymity is to protect us from the outside so that we can say what we see here, who we hear here, and what is said here does not leave here. But I need to know when I go home tonight that I can look if I have to and find somebody if I need to make that call. And you can't do it. Like, for instance, our group has a telephone book. And in our telephone directory, because we have such a large group, they said, well, we can put the first names and last initials. I said, well, that's real good. We got 5 Cindy R's. Now what do we do? Cindy R1, Cindy R2, Cindy R3, Cindy R4. And then you got to remember who you talk to. Which one are you? Are you Cindy R1, Cindy R2, Cindy R3? You know, I said, it's real hard. It's just real hard to do that. So in our phone book, we have everybody's name listed, the full name. And that's because the autonomy of our group said, that's what we want to do because our group's so large we couldn't find anybody. Now, they only got 1 MERP. I'm not worrying about that. You know, but the bottom line is there are lots of people. You know, we have 2 ANWs. You know, we have a lot of duplications with the size of group that we have. So it's really, it's nice to know. But I also, you explain to the person you're sponsoring, don't go home and start your sentences like this. My sponsor said. Because now the person at home hates your sponsor. You know, and the thing of it is, what they'll go home and tell their person they're living with may or may not be what you said. Because you hear it weird. You hear it the way you want to hear it, you know. Like, for instance, if I say to you, don't accept unacceptable behavior, they'll go home and say, my sponsor said I don't have to put up with your shit anymore. Now, see, that's not what was said. But that, and so all of a sudden, well, who the heck is that, you know? Or I'll have somebody come up to me and they'll say, this is my aunt. This is Mert, my sponsor. Remember I told you all about her? Yeah. I always love those, you know. And I said, I don't really care about the anonymity thing for myself, but it's not yours to share. It is my anonymity. And you don't have permission to break it. I do. No more than I have permission to break your anonymity. You know, when I go home or whatever, I might say, if you've noticed, I've said Ann W., I've said this and this, but you don't know who I'm talking about because I'm not breaking their anonymity. But, you know, I had a girl one time that came to our group, and I didn't even sponsor her, but she kept telling her husband about Mary Pearl or Merp, and all of a sudden he symbolized me as the enemy, you know? And so one night when he got drunk, he got pretty violent with her, and he asked her for my name and address and phone number, and she gave it to him. And then she called me, and she said, well, first of all, he called and told me that I'd ruined his life, and he was coming over to kill me. And doesn't necessarily make you feel good, you know. Now, I know that 9 times out of 10, that's a drunk talk, but there's that 10th out of 10 you don't know. And so it doesn't make you real comfortable. And I was home alone. My husband worked nights. And here it was, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm getting a call from a guy who's drunk, says he's going to come kill me. And so in a few minutes later, and I didn't know who he was, and she called and told me what had happened, and I said, well, I want you to know that in the event that he does come, I am going to call the police. And in the event that they don't get here soon enough, and if he tries to come in, I will blow his head off. I do want you to know that right on the front end. And I said, because I'm not going to be abused by that. But I said, don't ever break someone's anonymity like that. Don't put somebody in danger like that. That's so unnecessary and uncalled for. But see, she didn't know any different. She didn't know any different. And you'll forget. You just people are human beings, and they forget. You know, I've been with my sister in the mall, and somebody will come up, you know, and I'll say, hi, Chris. How are you today? This is my sister, Dorothy. Dorothy, this is my friend, Chris. And then we walk off. And then my sister would say to me, how do you know Chris? How do you know Chris? Where do you know her from? And I've learned to say, we have a mutual friend. We met through mutual friends. I don't have to say she's a member of Al-Anon or she's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's none of my sister's business. My sister's not in this fellowship. Now, if my sister were another Al-Anon member, I'd say, Chris, this is my sister, Dorothy. Dorothy, this is Chris. And if Chris chose to say, are you going to the meeting tonight? I would answer her. But I would not break Chris's anonymity by saying to my sister, this is Chris, she's in Al-Anon. Because that's not mine to do. That's Chris's to do. So we need to stress that, especially with newcomers. Sometimes, like I said, it doesn't hurt with the old-timers either. I did an anonymity break one time that was sort of a little different. I had this girl that I was sponsoring. I'd known her all my life and her husband, and I was over at the AA meeting right before it started, and I was getting ready to leave, and I talked to Don, and I said, oh, Don, tell Jennifer we missed her at the meeting last night. No big deal, right? No big deal. The big deal was Don didn't know Jennifer wasn't at the meeting that night. Uh-huh. Oops. Okay. Now, what had happened was Jennifer was going to the meeting. She passed the neighbor's house. There were a bunch of cars. She thought, I wonder what's going on. She rolled down her window. They said the neighbor's husband had died. She stopped. She went in, and she visited with her neighbor. She didn't get to the meeting that night. When she got home, he was already in bed asleep. He left before she got up the next morning. He had not been home. There was no way she could have told him. He left that meeting and went and got drunk and then came home and gave her hell all night long. That she was running around on him and all this kind of thing. You know, our insecurities. If you got, whenever you hear something, you're going to hear it through that feeling of fear or whatever. And what Don heard was, I told him Jennifer wasn't there. That meant she was out screwing around on him. That's what he heard in his head. And see, I caused her a lot of grief by saying she wasn't at the meeting, whether she is or isn't. If I wanted to know why she wasn't at the meeting, I should have called Jennifer. Shouldn't have said something to Don. So you learn, you know, that's one of those things you learn. And I had to end up making an amends for that. But thank God we have amends steps so that we can clean up the messes that we make. You have to stress that the living in sponsorship and in the program is a 24-hour deal, one day at a time. There's nothing that is so bad that you can't get through it for today, one day at a time. And we have a tendency to live in the future and not in today. So that's one of the things I need to stress. And what good does it do to live in the past? You know, what's it going to change? What's it going to change to go back and keep rehashing the past? I love this, especially with those that were raised in alcoholism that I sponsor. They kept going on and on and on. I say, you know, sometime or other, you have to give up all hope of a better childhood. You know, it ain't going to happen here. I'm sorry. We do not go back and recreate childhoods and make them happy. We just don't do that. You have to accept the fact that that's the way it was. And there's another thing. How much time do you spend thinking about what you think somebody else is thinking about you? You know? My sponsor told me, he who walks in another's mind is lost. Because what you think I'm thinking is usually not what I'm thinking. And that's so self-centered that we think that other people, all they're thinking about is us. Get a grip, folks. The Serenity Prayer, she taught me. You know, I remember when I came and where we started today with the Serenity Prayer. I didn't know the Serenity Prayer. I had heard the Serenity Prayer, but I didn't know the Serenity Prayer. It didn't make any sense either. And I got it down. I memorized it, though. You know, I'm good at memorizing things, so I got down and memorized it. And I probably sat in meetings for 3 or 4 years before I ever understood what the Serenity Prayer was talking about. It took me a long time. But she told me to use it for my temper. Because I got here, I had so much anger. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, instead of cussing somebody, why don't you say the Serenity Prayer? So I said, okay. So many times I would say the Serenity Prayer like, God, grant me the serenity to keep from killing that son of a bitch. Sometimes I would be so confused that I couldn't get anything more out than God, grant me serenity. Couldn't remember the rest of the prayer. But I kept doing it. I kept doing those things over and over and over and doing them until they began to make an impact in my life. She also informed me that as long as I allow what other people say or do, or don't say or do, to affect my way I feel, then I have not taken step one. Because she said, you haven't admitted and accepted your powerlessness over other people, places, and things if you do that. If you keep letting what other people say or do keep you tore up on the inside, it's because you're not accepting other people, places, and things just as they are. And, you know, I have a hard time with that because, see, if it's not the way I want it to be, I don't want to accept it. Because to me, acceptance was you put your stamp of approval on it. And that's not true. You can accept things you don't like. I've learned to accept a lot of things. I'm getting old, and I don't like getting old. But compared to the alternative, it's really good, you know. You know? She also taught me that there was no problem in my life that I couldn't find the solution to by working the steps. And that's true. If I admit my powerlessness over it, if I take the second step and realize there's a power greater than me that has the answer, and if I'm willing to turn my will and life over to that power, and if I look at what part I've been playing in the mess, I can go right down through those steps on any problem of my life. And I do that when I get sick and tired of playing with it, then I will go ahead and do the solution. Like I say, I do believe in the RPMs. They, you know, on a car, the RPMs, that's what they rev you up with. Well, that's the reading, prayer, and meditation every morning. That's where I like to get started off, and we call it our morning RPMs. We do those to get started. And a good morning routine starts with you on your knees. And for people who have been in a faith where you had to get on your knees, you may have an aversion to that. That's okay. We have little methods to do that, too. When you go to bed at night, if you take your shoes and throw them under the bed, then the morning when you have to get on your knees to get down under the bed to get your shoes, say your prayers while you're there. It'll work. Because we need to know we can't. That's the bottom. I got tickled. One of the girls in our group, she said, you know, our bathroom at work is so dirty, I just hate to get on my knees on that damn bathroom floor in that stall. And I said, take a mat. And then I wrote a letter to the store and complained about the bathroom. It's real funny. No control. That's true. It is no control. I'm a customer in that store. And I may have to use that bathroom. But to see, they'll do it for a customer when they want for an employee. It's a bummer, but that's reality. You know? Okay. Long-distance sponsorship. I don't know if y'all ever thought about that, but now I do some long-distance sponsorship. I have people that I sponsor in Texas, and I have one in California, and I have two in Canada. I have one in Alabama. I have one that was in Mississippi that has now moved to Texas. I have one in Florida that I sponsor. And now, these were not newcomers to the program, but these were people that over a number of years in the program wanted to work the steps the way we work them with a structured sponsorship. And it's expensive, sponsorship. Long-distance phone calls are expensive. But we also send tapes back and forth to one another. And you'd be surprised that having the tape is actually better than a letter, because in the tape, I can hear what they're saying as well as how they say it. And it really, that's been good. Now, in our sponsorship family, I have what I call my tools of torture. If you're having a problem with a character defect, and you've been asked repeatedly to make some changes in that area, and if you haven't chosen to do so, we have what we call willingness developers, or they call them tools of torture, you know. And like, for instance, if you have a tendency that you like to stir up shit, you get to carry a big mixing spoon. Now, you say, well, that's silly. Maybe, but there's a certain amount of embarrassment factor that goes with that spoon, and you have to carry it with you everywhere you go. And that means that everywhere you go and somebody asks you, what are you doing carrying a giant mixing spoon? You say, because I like to stir up shit. You'll be surprised how you'll become willing to quit doing that. I have a cross that's about like this by this, a big wooden cross. And down the front it says, I love to suffer. And across this way it says, martyrdom is great. Okay? And these are for the people that love to wallow in the martyrdom and the self-pity, you know, the kind that nail themselves to the cross every day anyway, so they get to carry it. And my first recipient of carrying the cross happened to be the parish secretary. And the Monsignor loved it. He just thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. He said, I would never have thought to tell you to do that, but he said, that's good. And, you know, she said, it was just really humiliating going to the grocery store in your shopping cart with this cross that everybody looked at her. They know she's the church secretary, and they said, isn't she sweet and wonderful? And she said, no, I'm a martyr, and I'll have to hang on the cross. You know? Then we have a gavel for those who are judgmental and critical. It's a real gavel on the little metal part. It says, here come the judge. You know? We have a little pacifier for the whiners, Chris. Not just the little buttons, but it's actually, you wear it around your neck like a necklace, this little pacifier, and every time you start whining, we tell you, stick it. I'm sure you'd write that down. That's good for her. And we have a lily, a long-stemmed silk flower, but it looks like an Easter lily, and that's for the ones who are so lily pure, the self-righteous bitches of the world, you know. Oh, they really hate to get that one, you know. They really hate. I have a bullwhip. A leather bullwhip, and that's for those who like to beat themselves. You know, the person who makes a mistake and can't forgive themselves, you know? Good. When you whip yourself, do it good. You know, we're not going to be half-psych here. I have an abacus, which is the little beads and stuff that you keep count on, and that's for people who like to keep score. Oh! Is everybody identifying here? Aren't you glad you're here instead of there? And the way we do these... in the meeting, that during the portion where it says, are there any announcements? We say, well, we don't have an announcement. We have an award tonight. And we have a little one of these little wands that has the little stuff that slides back and forth in it with the little stars. This is our reality wand. Those are for people who like to stay in their fantasy world, you know. So we have lots of different tools of torture going on. And people, they just hate to get them. But you know, the thing about it is, I have some that when it comes time for them to pass those tools on, they don't want to give them up. I've got one that she said, please don't take the cross away from me. Please do not take. She said, it has helped me so much because she said, it's been a constant reminder in me how I martyr and feel sorry for myself. And she said, I can't do it as long as I have that cross. And I said, well, you're going to have to feel sorry for yourself because somebody else is going to get it. I said, you've grown past that point. You need to pass that on, you know. And I think also if we're not careful, they get addicted to the attention that the tools give them, you know. What are some of the side benefits from sponsorship? I have some of the neatest relationships with people. When I got here at this program, I only knew how to have one person in my life at a time. I couldn't have five friends at a time. I had to have one, and I took that as a hostage. And I didn't dare have them have a friend with anybody else because then they might like that other person more than they did me. You know, and that was the way I did it. Well, now I can have many, 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 many friends because I've learned how to share. And some of the neatest things, like, for instance, with Jennifer. Jennifer and I grew up together. Our best girlfriends were sisters. And it never would have entered my mind. We were the older sisters. We were 3 years older than the younger girls. And they were the kind that were always wanting to tag along, do stuff. You know, the kind that were always in the way, the little younger kids that hassled you all the time. And she said, you were really mean to me as a child. I said, I'm going to be mean to you as an adult. Think on that. But Jennifer and I have shared so many, many special things. Like, for instance, one night, Jennifer was griping about the fact that her mother was drunk and she'd had to go get her mother in a really bad situation. And her father, when we were growing up, was the town drunk of our area. And he finally got to Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober. His wife went to Al-Anon for a little while and didn't want to give up any of her defects of character, so she kept going back out there. And she decided that maybe alcohol was the thing to do for her. And so she had to watch then her mother become an alcoholic. And she was very angry, and we were sitting there in the driveway at my house that night, and I said, you know, Jennifer, I said, when you had the measles and when you had the mumps and the chicken pox, I said, who was there for you? She said, my mama. I said, did she ever once look at you and say, you measled little wimp? And she said, no. I said, did she ever bawl you out for having one of your sicknesses? And she said, no. And I said, then don't bawl your mother out for being an alcoholic. I said, she's just sick. She's not sorry. And it's real hard when it's your mom. You know, men, there's things that are socially acceptable for men to do in the double standard that is reality that is not acceptable when it's a woman. And a man does it, and it's, well, he's being a man. If a woman does it, then she's being bad. And she said, it's just real hard. And I said, well, you've got to love her. And I said, I'm getting ready to go to Hawaii, and I'm going to leave on your birthday, and I'm going to let you have the opportunity to take me to the airport. Aren't I good to you? And she said, why don't you take me with you? And I said, no, because you got work to do here. And I said, while I'm gone, I'm going to give you an assignment. And I believe in giving people, I sponsor assignments, to give them things to work on to help them to get through things. And I said, what I want you to do is, I want you to go, and I want you to ask God to go with you, and I want you to be around your mother for the 2.5 weeks while I'm gone. And I want you to get in there, and I want you to treat your mother like a kind and loving daughter, and I want you to tell your mother, I thank you for all the things that she's done for you all these years of your life, and I want you to give her some positive strokes instead of ripping her apart about her drinking. And she said, I don't care. I don't want to do that. I said, I don't give a damn what you want to do. I said, that's what you're going to do because I'm going to ask you when I get back, and you better give me a good response. And I came in the house, and I marched in, and I turned to J.D., and I said, I just gave Jennifer the best pep talk I ever needed to hear. Because, you see, I had a real rotten relationship with my mother, and I realized when I was telling her some of those things that my mother had been there for me during those times, too. Well, I went on off, and Jeffrey took me to the airport, and I went zipping off to Hawaii for 2.5 weeks, and when I came home, it was the 3rd of July. Well, on the 5th of July, Jennifer's mother was killed in an alcohol-related incident. And you know what she had done while I was gone? She had done what I told her to do through sponsorship. She had no regrets with what she'd been with her mother. She had been able to make an amends to her mother for the way she'd been treating her. She was able to tell her mother she loved her, and she healed that relationship between her and her mother in that 2.5 weeks that she wouldn't have done because she wouldn't have been told to do it. Because a lot of times we just don't do things until we're forced to do them. And the reason, you know, it wasn't through any beautiful, brilliant insight on my part. It was just what God told me to tell her that night. It was one of those spur-of-the-moment things that you don't think about it. It's just a God thing. And God gives you the assignment to give that person. And I'm really grateful, and she is too. Because, you know, when we go out to the cemetery to visit our families, we don't have any problems out there. We don't have any regrets to go through, you know. It's just like one of the girls in the group, her father died recently, and she said, are you going over to the National Cemetery? I said, oh, shit, time for a family reunion. You know, because I got 2 brothers, a mother and a daddy, an aunt and 2 uncles out there. I said, it's a family reunion when I go to the cemetery. But it's okay. It's okay. I have a special relationship with a little girl that I went to a conference up in Missouri. She was from Kansas. And she'd come down to that conference with her boyfriend. And we got to talking, and after that conference, she wrote me a letter, and she said, would you sponsor me? She said, I want you to know, the first lady I asked to sponsor me, I never saw her again. And she said, I never saw her. So she never came to another meeting. And said, and then the next lady I asked to sponsor me died of a heart attack. And she said, and then the next lady, and I'm thinking, do I want to sponsor her? She doesn't have a very good track record here with, you know, sponsors. I don't know that I want to do this or not. And so I said, oh, okay, I'll sponsor you. And I said, here's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to call me. And she was my first long-distance pigeon. And she calls it the world's most expensive fifth step because she got rerouted and she flew down and she ended up going all over the country because of bad weather that weekend and finally staying in hotels and what have you got there, and we did it. But did you know we have a real bond, and we like to go places and do things together. And it was real neat because, you see, she was living then after she married this guy. He was transferred to Arkansas. And I was able to be around her for 2 or 3 years, and then she moved to Omaha, Nebraska. And about that time, I started getting invitations a couple of years before that to go to Nebraska, so I knew a bunch of people up there. And I told her, I said, I know some people up there for you to talk to when you get there, you know. And we did that. To give you an example of the kind of fun that we have together, she's a little teeny, teeny girl. Her name is Tina, and we call her Teeny Weeny. And she's just as cute and as perky as she can be. And we were traveling to Missouri one time from Arkansas. We were going to a conference in Missouri, and we were driving, and we pulled in at this little truck stop. And when we stopped at this truck stop, we, of course, naturally needed to fill up and empty out. And so we went over to the ladies' room. Well, the way it was like a convenience-type store with a breezeway, and then the bathrooms were over here to the side. And so we went in the door, and it was just one big open room with a commode sitting over there at the side. Sort of interesting, you know, no booth, no nothing, you know, and a little sink. And so she goes running over there and takes care of herself, and then she says, there's no paper in this room. And we looked, and there's a blow dryer on the wall. And I said, well, I can do you, but who the hell's going to do me? You know, I knew as little as she is, I could pick her up, you know. But I said, so we got to laughing. Well, when we walked out the door of the bathroom, there was all these truckers in that breezeway, and they looked at us and went, meah! They had heard every word we'd said in that bathroom. So she's now known as Truck Stop Tina. But we've done a lot of crazy things together. Her husband would come to visit sometimes. He was with the railroad, and he would fly down or come down on his train, and she loves for me to bake cherry pies. That's her favorite in the whole world. And so I would always make one and put it in his briefcase and send it back home to her, you know. Those are special relationships because, you know, I couldn't have any children, but I have many children of the Spirit. And that's what I call the kids that I sponsor. And they're my children. And it's been a special relationship. I couldn't be any closer to her if I had given birth to her, I don't believe, because there's a special, special bond that's there. And then I have one I call Itchy Bitchy. You notice I do nicknames, you know. You know. This one, we were playing Trivial Pursuit one night, and she broke out in hives from the nervousness of it all. I play intensely. They say, don't sit next to her, because when you give the bad answer or whatever, it's, how could you do that? Play with a lot of intensity, but that's how I live life, with a lot of intensity, you know. I enjoy life. I enjoy life a lot. And she got to itching that night, so that J.D. said, well, she's just a regular little itchy-bitchy, isn't he? I said, that's good. We'll do that. So she's got the name. And these are special relationships that I would have never had, because you see, they're the kind of relationship where we can be honest and open with one another about how we feel. And if we get bent a little bit out of shape sometimes, it's okay, because we can tell each other, you know, I say, you know, I'm really angry at you. You really made me mad. And she'll go, oh, well, sorry about that. I wasn't on purpose. What did I do? And then I'll say, you did so-and-so. And then she'll say, well, and then we'll clarify that. You know what's called communication? It's not me just going around saying, oh, I'm not going to talk to her. Or when she calls, say, hello. Being cool. You know, that's how I used to communicate with people. Let you read my mind. You know, let me tell you what you're supposed to know. If you love me, you're supposed to know how I feel. You're supposed to read my mind. And if I get my feelings hurt, that's your fault, because you didn't read my mind. And I'm not going to give you a clue. If I have to tell you, it don't count. Now, there's only one problem with that kind of thinking. It don't work. That's the kind of things my sponsor pointed out to me. All those things I was doing that didn't work. All right, we've got a few minutes. I wanted to read with you your handout there. Discuss a little bit about that. What is a sponsor? Let's start with that one. What is a sponsor? A sponsor is someone you call on the telephone to tell her you're not speaking to her, and she listens to every word you're not saying. You know, I have told my sponsor I'm never going to talk to you again as long as I live, because she said something that hurt my feelings. And you know what hurts my feelings more than anything? The truth. Every time I heard something that I needed to hear in order for me to make changes, it pissed me off and hurt my feelings. I'd get real mad, and I'd tell her, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. And then I'd call her back the next day and say, I changed my mind. But what she heard was not that she was a bad person. She heard, I'm hurting. Because you know how when you know, it's sort of like I call the hit dog syndrome. I love dogs, and I raise dogs. And if the dog gets hurt and you go to help him, he'll bite you. Because he doesn't know where the pain's coming from. All he knows is he hurts. And that's sometimes like with us. We're like wounded animals, and we're in pain, and we don't realize that the person there to help us is there to help us. And all we know is we hurt and we bite them. And we're cruel and mean and say snotty things and blame them and do this kind of thing until we get past that. And then we can look back and say, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have done that. You know. A sponsor is the person you fear to lose. So you tell her you don't want to see her, and she still comes when you call. You know, that's it. I'd tell her, you know, I'm never talking to you again as long as I live. Then I'd call her the next day and say, I've changed my mind. Changed my mind. A sponsor accepts your insanity even when you won't admit it. You know, there's a lot of them that, you know, we'll fight to the bitter end thinking we're right, when we're crazy as a Betsy bug. And I call that sometimes it's like with my dead bug syndrome. I draw a lot of little mental pictures in my mind. Have you ever watched a bug die? Think about it. They go zip. And then they bounce against the wall, and then they zip around over here, and they zing back and forth, and then they'll lay there and flip and buzz, 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 buzz until they finally croak on the floor. You've seen a bug die, haven't you? And that's sort of the way I'm going to try it again. Bounce against the wall, try it again. Do it over here, until I finally croak out and say, I was crazy. That won't work. That won't work. I usually know it won't work when I've had all the pain I can stand. That is, I've done pain a long time. And when I first came in, I could do great amounts of pain. Today, I don't do pain nearly so well because I know I don't have to. And before, I thought that if you gave up, you were a failure. And today, I know when you give up, you've just begun to win the battle. Because when you realize you can't, then you can get some help. As long as you think you can do it, you can't get any help because you won't ask for it. A sponsor knows you're only human when you're being God and judging her. Yeah. You know, those times when I thought, you know, well, let me tell you, you know, you think you're so damn good, and sit there or take other people's inventories, you know. That's where you play God. Now, I don't know how many of y'all have had that commission. I've not got mine yet. But I take that license, you know, every once in a while to get into that. And when that was one of my greatest things to try to overcome in the program was the defect of being judgmental and critical. And that's the easiest one for me to fall back in today. That's that idea that I know better, I'm smarter than you, you're stupid, you're doing it wrong, you're always doing it wrong if you're not doing it my way. That self-centeredness that comes in, you know, that's all it amounts to. And when I'm judging you, it's because I'm not okay. If I was okay, I wouldn't have to judge you. I wouldn't have to prove you wrong. Because judging's where I prove I'm superior to you. And if I'm okay, I don't have to do that. I don't have to tell that lie to myself. A sponsor remembers what you did when you had amnesia, and she still wants to know you. You know, there's times when you say, I don't believe they did that. There's times when you want to lay your head on the table and say, I don't know them. I do not know these people. But the bottom line is, when I'm doing that, I'm getting into it with them. I'm not responsible for what the people I sponsor do or don't do. I'm only responsible for what I do and don't do and what I tell them. That's what I'm responsible for, not what they do with it. You know, we had a situation at our meeting the other night. It was sort of comical. You ever noticed how when the meeting is going to screw up and you're going to really have a dinky meeting is when you have company? You ever notice that? Let you have a visitor, someone you consider important come. That'll do it every time. And our group was, we were having an all-women's conference week four last. And so we had a bunch of people in from Florida and some in from Texas and 10 or 11 people from Canada. And we had all these people there visiting at our group that night. And it's our regular staff study night. And I had gone to the airport and got the speaker, one of our speakers. And she's been a friend of mine for years. But she'd never been to Arkansas. She'd never been to our group. And I was so excited that she's going to get to come and meet the family. And I walk in the meeting, and I swear to God, that is not my meeting. What happened to our meeting? There was somebody talking at the podium at the step study, and I'm going, and all the people that are sitting there around the big, you know how we have that big square that we make of our tables and everything? They've got their back to the person speaking, and everybody's looking at everybody like, and it's like, what happened? I mean, I walk in, and I turn around, and I go back, and I sit down, and I'm sitting there, and I keep wondering, what is that woman doing? What is she doing up there? This is not the right format for this meeting. And everybody just keeps looking at everybody. And finally, I lean over to the girl that I sponsored that was sitting there in front of me, and I said, what's going on? And she said, she was supposed to get her one-year coin, but I think she's telling her story. And I said, how long has she been up there? 20 minutes. A 20-minute acceptance speech. I even beats the Academy Awards, you know what I mean? And I thought, you know, this is terrible. This is terrible, and it's not just terrible from the staff. I thought, God, we have company. That's the first thing that ran through my mind. Because, see, that's my pride in my group coming up there. You know, the pride of our group. You know, you think your group's the best in the world, and everybody should feel that way about their own group. And if you don't think it is, then you need to get in there and do what you can do to make it what you believe is the best group. And if that doesn't work, go on and go to another group. If that won't work. And I'm sitting there thinking, and then it went into, oh, dear God, she's embarrassing herself because when she looks back on this, she's going to be horrified that she's done this because she's going to know it wasn't the way we do it. And about that time, her sponsor, I got thick, I looked down the table at her sponsor, and her sponsor had her head on the table going, oh. And she was so embarrassed, and I thought, well, you don't have any control over that. You don't have any control over that, although she did have a little conversation with her after the meeting. We all make mistakes. It just seemed like that was, and I got to think about it later, it's funny, why not have it when we have everybody there? What the hell? You know, we're all human. We all have those kind of things. No big deal. A sponsor is responsible enough to care, but humble enough to know which decisions are yours or God's. In other words, the bottom line is I give all the choices and the options out, and then I say, but the bottom line is I don't have to live with that decision. You're going to have to live with it. So you and God decide. And there comes a point when I have to say to them, I'm sure you and God will make the right decision. Because the bottom line, that's not my job. My job is to show them where their choices are. What are your options? What would be? You know, because many times I get focused in and it's got to be black or white, this or this. And my sponsor can show me 15 areas of gray that I miss totally because I happen to be that all or nothing type person. And that helps me with my decisions. A sponsor stands by her other commitments as well as you, so you call her selfish. That's just like when I go out of town, they'll say, are you going out of town again? And I'll say, yes. Well, I don't like it. You were gone too much last year, and I need you. Always go out of town when I need you. And I said, I know, and I plan it that way. I was just saying to myself last night, I bet you that bitch is going to fall apart. And I can guarantee it by going out of town. I think I'll do that. I said, do you really think I do that? I said, the bottom line is, there are other people here that can help you just as well. And I got a newsflash. If I'm out of town, if you need to get a hold of me, God will provide the way for you to get a hold of me. And if not, then the person that you need is there. And quit looking over here. So many times we make the mistake of thinking we get it all from here when we get it from here, here, and here. You know, that's just like the disease of alcoholism. Alcoholism is a disease. I couldn't grasp that because it looked like they did it on purpose. I mean, a disease, can you see a disease grabbing a person and saying, take you to the bar? See, in my mind, I couldn't see that they were having that very disease up there working in their mind saying, go to the bar. You know, there's a solution over there. And it was very difficult for me, and I kept thinking, no, it's moral. It's moral. It's not disease. But I went to the meetings, and I met all these people, and one afternoon, I couldn't get a hold of my sponsor. And I needed to talk to her. I was at work, and I was having a crisis. It was going to happen next week. I knew it. My crisis is now, you know, but I got to have it, you know, taken care of. And so I couldn't get a hold of her, and so I called this other woman in the group. And I said, I'm having this deal, and I really need to talk. She said, well, why don't you come over? And I said, I will. And I left my office, and I got in my car, and I zoomed over to her house and opened the door to her house, and her husband was laying in the doorway, right inside the front door. He'd been laying there for several days. He would drink to pass out, and he'd come to, and he'd drink to pass out. And I don't have to tell you what kind of condition somebody's in when they haven't gone to the bathroom in a facility. They don't smell good. They don't look good. And she said, just step over, Bobby, and come on back to the kitchen. Well, I stepped over Bobby, and I went back to the kitchen. But I'm doing this the whole time. I'm looking back. Does she not know there's a man? I mean, he's laying there in the floor. He's in this bad, he's in bad shape, you know. And we're sitting down at the table, and she said, what's the problem? I said, damn if I can remember. I mean, I could not tell her why I came because, I mean, that blew me away. Does she not know there's a man laying inside this door? I mean, would you invite someone in your house to step over somebody and come on in? I wouldn't. You know, and I sit there, and I said, doesn't that bother you? And she said, oh, hell yes, that bothers me. She said, but you know he's sick. And see, I wouldn't have said he was sick. I would have been embarrassed by him, humiliated. That drunk bastard was there, and he was doing this to me. And here he is humiliating me in front of my friends. See, that would have been my deal. And I looked at her, and I said, sick. And she said, let me ask you something. Can you believe that anybody in their right mind would want to live like that? I came to believe alcoholism was a disease that day. I didn't get that from my sponsor. I got it from another person. So see, the sponsor can't teach you everything. But she had taught me to go to the meetings, and she'd taught me to call other people when I couldn't get her. And so I called Kathy. And the miracle is, that guy at that time had been in and out of AA for 12 years and had never achieved anything but 3 months of sobriety at one time. Not too long after, and you know, one of the miracles of Al-Anon was that you couldn't tell when Bobby was drunk by Kathy's behavior. And see, if my husband was drunk, I was absolutely horrible. I was crazy. But she wasn't, because she was working a program that told her she could be happy even if he was laying there drunk. That was his sickness, and she couldn't fix his sickness. God knows she tried. And she'd quit trying. And not too long after that, Bobby got sober. And Bobby's been sober ever since. And he's a minister today. Now see, that couldn't happen to that guy laying on that doorway. There was no way on earth that could have happened. But you see, God can take some of the ugliest things and make them into some of the most useful. And I'm really glad that I got to go there that day and step over Bobby and what have you, because, you know, Bobby was really interesting. I watched Bobby a lot after that when I'd see him at meetings, and he would look terrible. I mean, God, after he'd be drunk, you know, he would be so wasted for a long period, and he looked so pitiful. And he would hang on to the edge of the mantel of the fireplace at the building, and I'd think he's going to fall in the fire and die. because he didn't look like he could support his weight. And then you'd see him get to feeling a little bit better, and you'd see him drink again. You know, those kind of things. You watch that. And we'd just give up hope that Bobby was ever going to make it. And then one day Bobby made it. And it didn't look any different than any other day. But that was the miracle. That was his miracle. Her miracle was that certainly she cared, but she recognized he was sick. She didn't berate him for being sick. She didn't take it out on him for being sick. She didn't do all the things that I had done at that time. She had done them, but she had done them a long time ago. But it was neat. A sponsor is a tower of strength and a frail fragment of humanity. And that's the truth. You have to remember, we're all human beings. We can all make mistakes. She listens to your rotten days. Do you share your good ones too? See, I had a tendency to use my sponsor as a garbage dump. And I'd call and spill out all my garbage. And when I was having a good day, she'd say, "How are you things?" Well, fine. I'll handle it from here. You know. And I've learned to call her and to share those good things too. And you know, because I've walked the walk that I have over the years, when I was able to reconcile the deal with my mother and go through all of that years of hell, even in the program with my mother, and to then have some good years and then to watch her come back and get mentally ill and die, it was a long period of sickness, and the things that were going on were really difficult. And that's what my sponsor's going through today. You see, her mother's in the shape that my mother was. And so you see, I'm being able now to be able to share with my sponsor on an area that I've been through that she hadn't been through. But when she hadn't been through it, God provided another lady to come down and to walk with me through it. God has always given me what I need when I needed it. But it's real important for me to share the good times and not just the bad times. God, if I only got the bad times, wouldn't you, as a sponsor, wouldn't you just sort of overload on garbage if you didn't have any good things to share? And there's nothing that gives me greater joy than to hear one of my babies reach accept a step or a value, or to hear that God's working in their life. There's nothing that thrills me more. This guy I was sponsoring, he was having a real hard time with the God concept. And I told him, I said, "Well, you know, God met me on the England Highway one day and I was driving my car. Who knows where your God is?" I said, "The bottom line is," I said, "have you ever reached out and just give it a chance?" So one morning he called me and he was just about absolutely spastic. He said, "I got up this morning," he said, "I decided, okay, God, I want to know if you're really out there, and I want to know you're doing something for me. And let's see, let me give you a test. I need a God test. A white truck, that's what it is, a white truck. I want to see a white truck." Now, he lives on a cul-de-sac, and he said, there's no one up and down his street, you know, that has a white truck, and he just decided that'd be a good test, just see how good God was. And he said, he's standing there looking out his window, so I'm waiting for a white truck. Said he's sitting there looking down the street, and he happened to notice parked in his next door neighbor's driveway was a white truck. He said, "Where'd that come from? Where'd that come from?" He said, "Well, now that one doesn't count, because see, that one was parked over there in the driveway." And he said, and he stood there for about 30 minutes, six white trucks came down his street. And that's old Rick. And he said, "My God," he said, "enough with the trucks, I'm about to freak now." And he said, "Okay, how about airplanes?" And he said, he just played, but he called me. He was so excited because, you see, he believed there was something out there that was listening to him that day. And, you know, it doesn't make any difference how you meet God. If it's in a white truck or if you meet him on the England Highway, it doesn't really make any difference as long as you try to make the contact. And that was one of those really neat ones. And our sponsor is another sick person trying to get well. Never forget, and don't give your sponsor not the right to be sick herself or himself. You know, give them the right to have a rotten day. Give them the right to screw up. You know, everybody does it. And I had a tendency, I remember the first time I saw my sponsor get mad and lose her temper. That was scary. Because, see, you know, I never saw her lose her temper. And she was something bigger than life is what it amounted to. And I had to realize that she was a human being and she could do those things. And then I got to thinking, I didn't want to ever get to the point where I couldn't lose my temper occasionally. Occasionally. And let's look on those 12 steps of a sponsor. I will not help you stay in walla and limbo. I won't do that. I won't play those games. You're gonna grow or you're gonna go. It's that simple. I don't have time to waste on people who are going nowhere. My time is limited. I will help you grow to become more productive by your own definition. In other words, the things that you want to do, the changes that you want to make in your life. I'll be there for you and I'll help you grow, but I'm not going to help you to grow and be miserable and go backwards and stuff like that. I'm going to be there pushing you, doing a little prodding. I will help you become more autonomous, more loving of yourself, more free to continue becoming the authority of your own living. I'm going to give you the right to live your own life. You don't have to be a duplicate of mine. You don't have to do everything that I do. But if you want what I've got, you got to do the program like I do. If you want what I've got. If you don't want it, then don't do it. It's that simple. A lot of people say, oh, I want what you got, but I don't want to do that. I don't want to do those kind of things. I remember the first conference that I ever went to. I thought, this is the most wonderful thing in the world. I want to go to as many conferences as I can go to for the rest of my life because there's a special feeling I get when I'm there. And so I determined right then and there, I said, the way to do that is to be a conference speaker. That's what I'm going to do. That's going to be my goal. 5 years later, when I was asked to speak at a conference, I said, I can't do that. I can't do that. Sanity had come, you know. I said, I can't do that. And, you know, my sponsor told me, she said, you go and you do what you're asked to do within reason. In other words, if I've got a broken leg and if I need to be in the hospital, don't take me to a meeting, take me to the hospital, you know. You know, there's certain things, she said, but don't turn down the things that you're asked to do because you will grow more for them. You'll grow more. And she said, the things that you're, she said, and God gave you a message. And she said, God has given you a way to share your message that it can reach others. And she said, that's a gift. And God didn't give you that gift to set at home. He gave it for you to go and do. And so that's what I do as I go and do. But I don't feel today like I did that day when I said I'm going to make a decision to be a conference speaker because, you see, I felt very cocky and very this and that. But I know today that it's nothing. I'm no different than you, that there are no big deals in Al-Anon or AA. We're all just a bunch of kids trying to get well. That's all it amounts to. And I have to do what I have to do to get well. And part of that is getting out of myself by coming and sharing with people like you. I will help you. Let's see. I cannot give you dreams or fix you simply because I can't. I would love to. I would love to. But, you know, that's my disease, trying to fix people, you know, trying to fix them. I'd look at people, you know, and I'd say, they need me. And that gave me job security, you know. I like that. You know, I like that fixing. You know, if I fix you, then you owe me, and I'm in like Flint, you know. But I can't do that. And I can't give you your dream. Your dream is your dream. And there's nothing wrong with having dreams as long as you live in reality. You know, I have dreams and things. And the other day somebody asked me, they said, what have you not done in your life that you'd really like to do? And, you know, I was hard-pressed. I sat there for a long time and I said, you know, God has been so good to me that I couldn't possibly dream of doing the things that I've done. Why would I want to limit myself by dreams of what I have to come? Why would I want to put that limitation on myself? Because I would have shortchanged myself. You know, J.D., one of my dreams was that on our 25th wedding anniversary that J.D. and I would go to Hawaii together. Wouldn't that be nice, you know? And I'd been to Hawaii several times because I love it over there, and I wanted him to come and enjoy it. And normally he stayed home and worked so I could go, you know, one of those kind of things. And it didn't work that way. Because of this program, when we were married 17 years. I was called and asked to speak at the 25th anniversary of AA in Hawaii and would I like to bring my husband. And what day was I talking on? My wedding anniversary. So you see, I would have shortchanged myself waiting for that 25. Instead, I got to go and experience that in 17. So I don't know what dream I would have today other than to just to be able to continue to live and, well, and not be so physically getting decrepit with age. I think that's part of it, too. But that's reality, too. You know, when you get older, you slow down. You don't do things you used to do. And you have to accept life on life's terms. I cannot give you growth or grow for you. You must grow for yourself by facing reality, grim as it may be at times. And sometimes, you know, reality sucks. That's as good as it gets on some days. But the bottom line that there is that I would love to be able to save the pigeons that I love from the hurts and the things that they have to face. But you can't. One of the guys that I sponsor week before last, his 28-year-old daughter was killed in a car wreck, the light of his life. And her little boy was in the car with her. She was killed instantly. A young girl who was going to seminary ran a stop sign. And her life will forever be changed also. And the little boy had some broken bones and liver damage and had to be air-vac to the hospital. And she also has a little boy in the second grade, and her husband is a practicing alcoholic. And the guy that I'm sponsoring, you know, that's his grandkids, you know. And his son-in-law, of course, now, needless to say, he's drunk all the time now, you know, because he can't deal with that pain either. that he's doing the best he can, and we can see that. But, you know, if you could save the people you love from those kind of pains, God knows you would, but you can't. But John is going to have to grow through that. And the thing of it is, going through these things, we call them, you know, another growing experience, you know. We do grow through having to go through those. You don't grow so much in the good times. You ever notice that? Because we have a tendency to sort of sit back and then just rub all over them and just enjoy the hell out of them. And I think we're supposed to. But then there comes a time when you have to, you know, all things come to pass. The good times pass as well as the bad times. And we have to take what we learn in those bad times, apply it in our life. And that's how we have better good times. It's because we know how to enjoy them instead of keep living back there in the problems. We can live in the now. I cannot take away your loneliness or pain. God, you'd love to. You'd love to save them from that. I can't sense your world for you, evaluate your goals, or tell you what's best for you in the world. You have your own world. You have the right to decide how you want to live your life. And if you want to know how to live it more abundantly, we have 12 steps that will help you to do that. But life is out there, and abundance is a really good word because that means a whole bunch of. And I never got enough of anything. You know, I always had the disease of more. I cannot convince you of the crucial choice of choosing the scary uncertainty of growing over the safe misery of not growing. You know, sometimes we just are really comfortable in a pile of shit because it's warm, it's known, you know. But just because you're in there doesn't mean you need to be there. You know, and sometimes we have to make those choices to move on and to get out of that safe misery we're in. It's like every day I know I can do this, I've done it before, and God is depressing. Is that living or is that existing? A lot of times we can exist in that mire that we're in, but it's not really living. It's not loving anyone either. So sometimes we have to make those choices to go out there, and when the fear of the known becomes greater than the fear of the unknown, you're willing to take a chance. When the certainty of having to live another day, not feeling any better than this, when everything is bound to be up from here, that's when you make that choice. Make that choice to grow. And it's like giving up a defective character or having to maybe go a different direction in your life than what you wanted to. Or maybe you see yourself and your partner pulling apart from one another. You know, the bottom line is it's a selfish program from the standpoint it's self-caring, and you have to do what's best for you. And you have to allow sometimes people that you love to make choices that you don't like, and you may have to go through those times. That happens sometimes. But there's nothing there that God won't be with you through. I want to be with you and know you as a rich and growing friend, yet I cannot get close to you when you choose not to grow. When a person continues to stay in the sickness, I can't just go down in there. You know, the difference between a lot of different people who are organizations that want to help you is that they tell you, come on and get better and come along with us. Whereas we'll go down in the pit and we'll get you by the hand and we'll drag your butt out. You know, we'll help you to walk out. And I tell the people I sponsor, you know, I will go through hell with you, but I'll drag you not one step of the way. Because you've got to want to take that for yourself. I can't give you the desire to be different. That has to come from within. All of our solutions come from within, not from without. Because my pain level outside wasn't the big deal. The pain level on the inside was the big deal. And that's where the changes have to start. When I begin to care for you out of pity, when I begin to lose trust in you, then I am toxic, bad, and inhibiting for you and for me. When I begin to know that I can't trust you, that you've lied to me, and that we're not dealing in reality, when I lose my perspective where you're concerned, then I'm going to be very judgmental and critical of you, then I have to let you go for your sake and for mine. You know, it's sometimes that I have to get away from the sickness in order to be okay myself. Because that sick calls to sick. And when you're trying to get well, sometimes it's just real difficult to be getting well when there's such great sickness right there with you. Sometimes you have to give yourself a little distance in there. And you must know my help is conditional. I'll be with you, hanging there with you, as long as I continue to get even the slightest hint that you're trying to grow. But when I see that you're not growing and that you don't want to go and that you've gone as far as you want to go, then I need to take my energies elsewhere to somebody who wants them. Remember, it's a program for people who want it, not just for people who need it. Everybody in the world could benefit from a 12-step way of life, I'm sure. But the bottom line is, are you willing to do it? And a lot of people, you know, we see them come through the doors and go back out there. They have to hurt. I always get tickled, you know, when I've had one that I've sponsored, say, for 2 or 3 years. You know, there seems to be, in our area, I don't know how it is here, but you have a bunch of the long-timers instead of old-timers. You notice I changed that. There's a bunch of the long-timers, and then you have a gap of maybe 5 or 10 years in there, and then you have a bunch of people that make it to 5, and then you have those, you know, they make it that 1, 2, and 3, and then after 5, there seems to be a big gap, say, between 5 and 10, 12 years, something like that. And what happens, you know, it's a lot of times we get real self-satisfied, and we've grown, and we got a little complacent, and then we don't have to go to those meetings anymore, because, see, I don't need that meeting anymore. You know, I've been around a long time. Why do I need that meeting? Why in the world would I need a meeting? And if everybody only went to a meeting when they needed a meeting, there wouldn't be anything there for you. I got a newsflash. You know, if I didn't go to the meetings when I feel good, I wouldn't have anything to share with you. And therefore, when I feel bad, I can go and share that too, you know? And there has to be somebody there for me to get something off of. So if everybody only goes when they feel bad, I don't want to be at that meeting, I can tell you that. I have been to some like that. And I don't want to go to that kind of meeting. But when the person decides that they don't want to do the growth deal anymore, then I have to release them with love or indifference or aggravation or whatever. I have to release them at any rate in order to get my freedom from the emotional bond there so that I can go on and live and be okay. It's like if you decide to die, that's your choice, but I'm going to decide to live for today. If you can accept all of this, then perhaps we can help each other to become what God meant us to be. Mature adults, leaving childishness forever to little children. Have you ever thought about how childish we are at times? I came in the program and I didn't realize that all of that self-centeredness was so much like a little child. You know how little kids want their way regardless? You know, I want to do it. Everybody else is doing it. And then you get the, I don't give a damn what everybody else is doing. You're not going to do that because you're mine, you know. That childishness that we want to be like lemmings running off into the sea just because everybody else is. I want my way, and I want it right now. And I've given that up, and you know what I got in its place? The ability to be childlike. Now, there's a big difference between being childish and being childlike. When you're childish, you're being selfish and cruel and all those little things. You know, kids are cruel to one another. But when I can be childlike, that means that I can go and I can have fun. And I can play. And I can let the little kid in me that when I was growing up that would never had the opportunity to come out and play because I had to be grown from the get-go, being raised as an only child around old people. You know, I look at that now, you know, those people about the age I was, that I am now, you know. And I can understand little kids get on your nerves when you're my age. And so therefore, we all had to act older than we were, you know. And so, but now I can be a little kid. So I had to get old before I could be young. And have the fun and the freedom to be able to get out there and take the risk of appearing stupid or silly or both